The AutJet Business Show is your gateway to expert business advice and real-world success stories. Each week, a different leader in the business world will share their tips, insights, and lessons, offering you practical advice to navigate your entrepreneurial journey. Whether you have a business idea or are just starting out or looking to elevate your existing business, the AutJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Ensure you get these transformative conversations live on Thursdays at 6 p.m. or find the podcast at highfm.com. Let's build your business empire together.
Welcome, welcome. That's time of the week again. It's David Zeidel. This is the AutJet Business Show. And tonight we've got Brad Shawkind. Evening, Brad.
Good evening, David. Great to be here with you.
Excellent. And you're with me virtually. I'm in Joburg. Brad's in Cape Town as a new semigrant to Cape Town. And he's going to be sharing with us the fact that, one, he moved different places, but he's moved in different businesses as well. But as I always say, I'm going to start off with a little bit of a business lesson, and then we'll get into the interview and I'll introduce Brad before that. So the business lesson today is around a woman who was selling bread. She had a bread shop. And, you know, it's sometimes when you're selling something that is a commodity, that is the same as everybody else, then the only thing you can compete on is maybe the price, a little bit of the quality maybe. And instead of closing the business because it wasn't doing that well, she considered how can she change the way she does business. And what she did is started creating an environment where people came in and baked their own bread. So rather than getting bread, she allowed them to make their own bread, put the different things on Instagram, the different pictures of the experience. So she now was not just selling the bread, she was selling the experience. And the lesson from that is, you're selling the same commodity, but can you try and sell it in a different way? Could you get people involved in your business? There are always different ways of creating something brand new in your business. Look at what you're doing and see if you can turn that into an experience. So that's your little lesson for today. And hopefully we're going to get a lot more lessons from Brad. Brad is a behavioral specialist, high performance coach, keynote speaker, and a process facilitator. He spent the last 20 years helping people and organizations thrive, not just in theory, but in real practical ways. He's passionate about building workplaces where people want to show up and where real impact follows the people really showing up. As I said earlier, he's a serial entrepreneur. He started his business life as an architect, but has subsequently started over 20 different businesses and in many different industries, which means he truly understands the ups and downs of business. Whether he's talking leadership, strategy, culture, or innovation, Brad brings it back to what really matters, and that is, as in the story, people matter, or what he calls relationship nearing. I think he called it relationship nearing. Maybe he'll improve my English.
Relationship nearing.
Okay, I'll get that right. He's a published author of a book called We Are Still Human. He teaches at different business schools, Gibbs, Duke, and he regularly shares his insights with audiences around the world. He has not only reached peaks in business, he's also climbed, and I think he said three of the seven summits. The seven summits are on the seven different continents. He's already climbed three of those. And, I mean, getting time to even do that is beyond me. But, Brad, it's great to have you with us. Welcome to the show. And I want to start off by asking you, did you really climb three of the seven summits? And then the subsequent question is, why?
Yes, so I have. So the seven summits, for clarity, is the tallest mountain on each continent. Why is a long, there's a long backstory to what got me into mountaineering. But once I got there, I went off to Kilimanjaro to do my first climb, first big climb. And I say that because now that I'm in Cape Town, Capetonians have this weird delusion that Table Mountain is a mountain, whereas Table Mountain is a walk that you do before work in the morning. And I give them the comparison of Kilimanjaro is a 6, 7, 8 day adventure to serious altitude. And why for me is the first one was to prove to myself that I was still okay. I had broken my back. And while I was lying in hospital in recovery from crushing my spine, I watched a documentary of a guy who had summited Mount Everest, also having broken his back, also riding a motorbike. So there was a strong synergy in our stories. And I didn't even know if I'd ever walk again. And I pointed at the screen and I said, I'm going to have a go at that one day. And it took me many years to recover. And my back now is, I mean, strong, strong, strong. The summiting the mountains has proven that. But it was really just my ego wanting to be okay, because I'd come from a very physical background as a youngster. I played lots of sports. I played soccer very seriously, went overseas, did that whole gig. And now I didn't know if I'd walk again. So the first trip up Kilimanjaro was let me prove that I'm okay to myself. And the question you might want to ask is, why would you go back and do that again? Because I climbed Kilimanjaro the second time. And it was just a different route. It was a different challenge. It was leading a corporate group and different lessons the second time around. But then I went and continued climbing other mountains around the world. And the why really is because the challenge, it's very hard to explain to people what it feels like to stand on top of a continent. At that moment in time, we may very well be, and I say we because it's always with a team, we may very well be the highest people in the world because climbing mountains is seasonal. So there's a very good chance there's no one at a higher altitude in that moment on the planet than us. And that's its own euphoria in a way. But the real why is the amount of work, mental, physical, and emotional, that it takes to get there is profound. And everything is against you when you're climbing a mountain. It's in the freezing cold. It's temperatures of minus 20, minus 30. With a backpack on our backs, climbing up constantly day after day after day, with the oxygen getting thinner, it's everything we're not designed to do. So for me, the challenge is something I lean into. The other thing that makes it so enjoyable, even though it's not fun when you're up there, I love to travel. And these adventures have taken me to places I would never, ever have gone to if I was just going off to travel. But because the mountains are so remote, it presents unique opportunities to go to unique places. And so those are a couple of reasons why. And then the third part is the enjoyment of the connection with the team. I've got some incredible people that I do this with. And I get to experience incredible leadership on the mountains. Some of the best leadership experiences I've ever had were on mountains, and seeing what true leadership looks like. We need to take more of our corporate leaders and drop them off in the Himalayas and in some of the South American mountains and let them learn what real leadership looks like. And I'm hoping right there I've poked the bear.
So it's interesting. Just your story for me brought out so many different lessons or insights. So first of all, climbing the same mountain twice is not the same experience. It's a different experience. You learn different lessons even doing the same thing twice. The other thing is, you said lying in the hospital bed and you saw somebody who had been in a similar situation to you, that became inspiration. So seeing somebody else achieve something, that all of a sudden changed your mindset. Yes, it can be done, and I want to do it. And that person, even though maybe they weren't aware of it, they became your mentor. They became, they kind of encouraged you to do that. And then a lot of people avoid the challenges. And it sounds like you see the challenge and you go for it. And because it's difficult, you do that. And I want to unpack a little bit about that a little bit later on. Is that something that is just you, or is it something that you push yourself to do? Is it something that we can teach ourselves to do? Or if you're not that kind of person, are you just not that kind of person? And the fourth thing that I heard you say is it helps connect with the team. And that's the essence of you. Your whole essence is around high performance as teams. So it's interesting that just talking around these different things. You've brought out these different issues that we're going to unpack a little bit later on.
Right.
So I want to ask you about kind of your different experiences and your different businesses. And I want to ask you around, what was your first business? What were the lessons you learned around that? But I think we're going to unpack that just after the ad break.
The AutJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Let's build your business empire together.
Welcome back. You're listening to the AutJet Business Show. I'm David Zeidel, and we're busy talking to Brad Shawkind, who first of all discussed climbing a mountain after having broken his back and the challenge around that and the lessons that we learned through that. But before we went to the break, I asked him about his first, maybe, of the top 20 businesses or the 20 plus businesses that he's been involved in. What, first of all, what age were you at when you started the first business, and how did it start?
The first business that was while I was in the early years of my architecture studies. And it's going to be, this is a set of contrasts or a story of contrasts, because I'm not a gambler. I don't gamble. But my first business was, I was a poker player. And that was how I was earning money to fund my education. I needed cash, and I was good at understanding the game. So I played poker. And when I say poker, I wasn't hitting the casinos and doing high roller stuff. It was just some guys who were in their education, in their first and second years of education, who had a poker school. And we used to invite new people to come in and join us. But that was really just a way of networking. And that was the start of my journey into talking about relationships. The first real business that I was involved in was, at the same time, we used to manufacture and sell alcohol jellies, myself and a couple of partners. We had this very legal, in inverted commas, manufacturing facility in the basement of one of our homes. We were all living with our parents, who were 18 years old, and we were selling thousands of alcohol jellies. We had a food scientist who helped us formulate the recipe, and we were selling these to raves, to the clubs. The club scene was huge at that stage. And this was my parents' fridge. It was full of beer trays, full of tequila, sambu. And again, I didn't gamble, and I don't drink alcohol. So I was in two businesses, neither of which were in any way part of my lifestyle, but they were giving me great income with which to have. I was the richest. That's the stage, I believe, anybody who's studying and working at the same time, that is when you are the richest, because you are still living off the comforts of the parental home. You've got more cash than you've ever had in your whole life. And where you are the poorest is when you qualify and leave home, because now you start having the lowest salary you're going to have in your life, but the most expenses. And that first business was a great business. I would get calls at 2-3 in the morning from the clubs to come and deliver alcohol, and off I'd go. But at the same time, I was also trying to complete an architecture degree, and managed to get that done. And then not long after that, got into real business, which was the business of practicing architecture. And that's when I really leaned into my true entrepreneurial self, because the alcohol business was a side hustle, but it wasn't a business that, other than it was a trading business. We were just moving commodity, making it and selling it. That was all it was about. It was really just how to move product on demand. But again, lessons in there that's the fundamental of any business is, well, have you got something people want? There's that word demand. And do you know how to get it to them within the time frame that they want it, in the volumes that they want it? And it's interesting, that one, because we had to make sure we always had stock, because we got calls at strange hours of the morning. Brad, we're out of jelly. We need jelly. And I mean, this is a 3 o'clock call on a Saturday morning when all I want to do is sleep. And the reason I say it's so interesting is because yesterday I was in a strategy session with the CEO of one of our, obviously I'm a professional secret keeper, so I won't mention names, but the challenge that this CEO is having right now, and I'm talking about a multi-billion rand, one of our big retailers, they're getting pressure from their shareholders to reduce their stock holding. And he's pushing back, saying, but the thing that brings our customers through our doors is they know that they're going to find it on the shelves, not that they have to wait, or not that we have to order it for them. And it took me back to those days. One of our principles was people don't want to wait anymore. They don't want to wait at all. We live in an instant gratification society, and retail has to be able to compete and make sure that they're satisfying that need. So the lessons of 35 years ago still apply.
So I want to ask you, just related to that business. So first of all, how did you come up with the idea? So you said there were a few of you involved. How did you come up with the idea? And once you had the idea, how did you sell it to, and you weren't selling it to individuals. You were selling it, if I understand correctly, to the clubs. And how did you manage to sell it? So because a lot of businesses, it's around one, the product, two, having the customer, and three, getting it there, in, as you said, in time. So if you wouldn't mind just trying to unpack that a bit.
Yeah. So was that one wasn't my idea. I tagged on to the idea of the partners, and we developed it together, and it developed beyond just jelly into test tubes, and we developed the product range. The how part, in terms of becoming visible, was we used to cold call. We would pick up the phone. I mean, this is the days of when cold calling. Now I don't cold call. It's not a strategy I apply. But back then we would pick up the phone and say, this is who we are, this is what we do, and this is why you need to have a look at it. And the reason why was because they didn't have to pour the drinks. They didn't have to pour the shots. They didn't have to make the jelly. It was literally, they could sell hundreds to a group of partygoers in seconds. We gave them a technique. We had tequila. I mean, some nowadays the terminology might be off, but they were tequila girls or jello girls, and they'd be walking around with their outfits. You can imagine what that looked like. And they were selling hundreds, if not thousands, of these products at enormous margins. It was a rationale that the nightclubs, the bars, the party organizers couldn't argue with. And all it took was a little bit of activity to create exposure, because people were hearing about the product. So when we phoned, they knew who we were. And we just had a long list. And when I say list, we were far and wide, as far north as you can go, as far east as you can go, as far west as you can go. We even used to do trips down to the, I'm trying to remember, the festivals at the various different universities. We were everywhere. But it started with a little bit of movement. And that's what business is, break traction and create exposure.
And I think, so I had a few sessions with some businesses today where we were talking about different things. And I kept saying to them, you have to be solving a problem. And you kind of solved a problem, but more than that, you added value that they could now, as you said, sell a whole lot of different things. And you created something that didn't exist, but you turned it into great value for them. So one other thing, from a pricing point of view, how did you determine, and again, we're doing this show so people can learn from what others are doing. What do you remember? I mean, it was a while back. Do you remember how you priced it? Was it priced on the cost that it cost you? Just go, if you can remember that far back, how would you price it?
So just to backtrack, you're spot on. The problem that we solved was, in those days, remember, this is 35 years ago. The problem we solved was variety, because it was variety and entertainment, because there was nothing like it in their environment. So that was a big problem we were solving. And speed of delivery, it was instant. The pricing was a very simple formula. We knew exactly what it cost us in terms of materials to manufacture X amount of, because we had zero wastage. We were able to know exactly what it cost to manufacture X amount of 100 or 1,000 shots. We added on to that the variable costs of our employees, and that was really it. And so we could work out in one day, what did the labor cost us? What did the materials cost us? How much did we produce? And then what was our selling price? And there we straight away knew our cost of sale and our